much did you pay for those books?
$18.
Oh, my Lord!
She lay digesting the enormity of the extravagance, but the more it grew in her mind, the less she could reproach him. Because she was hurt and shut in, because he felt bothered in his conscience for letting her get burned, because he was galled by the tightness of money and needed to do something to express his contempt for penny-pinching, he spent more in one insane gesture than she had been able to spend on the boy's clothes all winter. There was nothing you could say to him when he did a thing like that. He never even said outright that they were a present for you, though you knew they were. And even if there had been 100 presents more useful and acceptable, you had to like this one and love him for it. She got no news from him that night about what was happening in the settlement or the lumber camp, because she forgot to ask. But the next morning she saw him kneeling before the big black bureau he had built. He rummaged and felt in the back of a drawer.
"What are you looking for?" she said.
"The gun."
"What do you need the gun for?"
"Want to load it up for you."
Deliberately uncommunicative, he stooped and grunted, searching. Elsa sat up in bed.
"Why should it be loaded for me?"
The boys, who had been having a pillow fight in their own bed, craned to look as Beau pulled the .38 out of the bureau and slipped cartridges into the cylinder.
"I'm just going to leave it where you can get at it," Beau said. "Make you feel a little safer, maybe."
Grinning at her, he laid the gun on a high shelf out of the boy's reach.
"Now tell me," she said.
"Nothing to be scared of," Beau said. "There's been a cougar around prowling the camps, is all."
"A cougar?"
"Never bother a man. They're scared to death of a man. They just sneak around nights and steal fish and things. If you heard anything around at night, you could shoo 'em away with this. One shot would have him hightailing it for the next county."
Elsa looked sideways at the children, listening, round-eyed. He could say all he wanted. She was scared just the same. A cougar could get through a tent wall like nothing, and even if he was afraid of a man, he wouldn't be afraid of a child.
"Think I should keep the kids inside?"
"Ah!" Beau put the box of cartridges away. "They only prowl at night."
"Well, but—"
"Keep 'em around close if it makes you feel better. But there's nothing to be scared of. Bruce there could scare 'em clear into Oregon."
For the first hour after he left, she kept glancing out into the clearing. It would be another fine day. She tried to imagine cougars lying in wait behind the sunny edge of the trees, but the thought in such fresh morning light was absurd. At mid-morning she had the children playing outside and had settled herself with one of her new books on the step. Looking for something familiar, she found Romeo and Juliet. Once or twice, lifting her head from the book to make sure that the boys hadn't strayed, she wondered about what she was reading. Shakespeare was something great and far off, a vague, magnificent name. She couldn't remember ever knowing anyone who had read any Shakespeare, though Beau had told her about one night in Indianapolis when he saw Macbeth a long time ago, and about the flames flying around a dark stage and three old hags dropping the finger bones of children into their pot. Now she was reading one herself, and it was much like any other story, except that it was in poetry and there were some words she wasn't sure of. But it was a good story. She read again, and Romeo had just killed Tybalt in a street brawl when Bruce called. He had to go to the toilet. Absorbed in her reading, Elsa told him to go by himself. He was a big boy now. Watching him with one eye, she saw him start unwillingly on the path that led back into the fringe of trees, looking back all the time, dragging his feet. He got halfway, looked into the jungle of blackberry bushes, stopped, and began to cry. Elsa put down her book.
"Go on," she said. "A big boy like you shouldn't need help."
Chester, sitting on a stump, swinging his legs and watching, said,
"I go by myself, don't I, Ma?"
"Of course," she said. "All big boys do." Bruce only wailed louder, and she stood up. He was a difficult child, cried for any little thing, grew afraid at nothing, got stubborn, helpless streaks. No wonder Beau got mad at him, but it wouldn't do. You had to baby him or he got worse. She walked out to him.
"Come on, then,"
she said, and took his hand. He hung back, staring fearfully into the woods.
"What are you afraid of?" she said, and pulled at him.
The child screamed and hung his whole weight on her hand. The effort of hauling at him sent a deep, throbbing ache through her injured arm, and her impatience grew.
"What is the matter with you?"
It was minutes before his screaming stopped. She had to give herself up to the job of quieting him, sit down by him, distract his attention, tell him a story. Then she took his hand again.
"All right," she said. "Let's go do our business."
His round eyes swung to the woods again, and his lip jutted.
"Cougar'll eat me."
"Oh."
Elsa opened eyes and mouth in understanding, pursed her lips, and nodded. In a substratum of consciousness, she felt irritation with Beau for making so much fuss about the cougar that morning. The first thing he knew, the child would be afraid to go 10 feet by himself.
"The cougar's gone home," she said. "He lives way over by Lake Sammamish."
"He does not," Bruce said. "He's in the woods, and he's going to eat me."
"No, he isn't in the woods."
She rose, wincing at her throbbing arm.
"Look, I'll go in first and show you."
She walked into the brush, slipped off the path, and hid herself from him. Peeking from a thicket of blackberries, she saw him sitting on the ground, his whole face set for a wail, watching where she had disappeared. After a moment, she came back on the path.
"See?
Isn't there a cougar?"
"Not a sign of one. Come on with me now."
Finally she got him to the privy and back, but her nerves were tried, and as she sat down again to read, she thought in irritation that there wasn't much real peace in living in the woods a mile from town, with cougars running around robbing camps, and your children afraid, almost justifiably, of being eaten by wild beasts. But that wasn't fair. Beau wasn't to blame for the way they were living now. If anyone was, she and the boys were. They had been a millstone around his neck, a jinx. If he had had only himself to think of, he would be in Alaska now with Judd, doing what he wanted to do, living the kind of life he loved, instead of working 15 hours a day in a place he hated. Considering how much he had given up, it was no wonder he was sometimes irritable and brooding. The wonder was that he took his bad luck as well as he did. He had every excuse to be as miserable as he was that winter they went back to Indian Falls. She couldn't remember much about the arrival home except a pattern of confusion, embarrassment, humiliation, and amazement at the change in Kristen and Erling. Kristen had grown up. Her selfishness and her lack of responsibility were gone. As for Erling, he was a great raw-boned man at 18, an inch over 6 feet and looking bigger because of his mop of red curls. He was obviously glad to see her, and obviously not going to show it. She remembered the look of quick astonishment in Kristen's eyes, the sober, old-world courtesy in her father's manner when she introduced Beau, and she remembered Henry Mossman, mild, getting a little bald, stepping up to shake Beau's hand and then stepping back as if he had just shaken hands with the president. She felt the forced conversation as a guard against their saying what they really were thinking, and in the very quiet politeness of their manners she felt that they didn't like Beau. They had been prepared to dislike him, and now they did. He was only a big, dark-faced man who had run a saloon or pool hall in North Dakota and tricked Elsa into marrying him. He was outside the pale of Christian society, son-in-law or no son-in-law. She knew also that Beau felt their careful courtesy for what it was, and that even before they reached the house he was despising them for a bunch of pious Scandahoovian hypocrites. They were oil and water. Though with the children, Beau got on better. Kristen he won over to a kind of giggling liking by teasing her until she flew back at him, when he backed away, waving helpless hands before him, and called her a hellcat. She was never quite sure of him, but she thought he was lots of fun. Erling, after the first day on the farm, was his slave. She remembered how that started. Beau, the first night, sat down after supper and lit a cigar and said, well, he guessed they were set for the winter, and Erling, maliciously acute, said,
you mean stuck?
All right, Beau said, stuck. Erling was eating an apple, pounding the hard red Jonathan on the table to pulp it and then sucking the cidery juice through a hole in the skin.
"You folks going to church regular?"
he asked. Bo blew out a cloud of smoke.
"No."
"Swell, then I won't have to."
"Don't go telling Pa we put you up to it," Elsa said.
"You got the right idea," Bo said. He reached in his vest and handed Erling out a cigar.
Erling took it, startled, but game. Elsa started to protest, but decided to keep still. Let him play.
They sat in a haze of smoke for 10 minutes. Erling took the cigar out of his mouth and looked at it, working his lips.
"Good cigar."
"Just about got you whipped, hasn't it?" Bo said.
"No, I smoke a corn cob generally."
"Not while Pa's around, I'll bet," Elsa said.
"You don't bother me. I'm running the farm myself now."
"You're the boss, huh?" Bo said.
"I'm the head man."
Erling took the cigar out of his mouth again between thumb and forefinger and went to the door and spat casually. Bo laughed.
"Got any good work for a good farmhand?"
"You want to work?"
"Sure."
"You'd get so lathered out in a field you'd drown out all the gophers."
"Sweat's good fertilizer," Bo said.
Erling looked at him doubtfully, his little bright blue eyes squinting. Elsa could see him thinking. If this big guy wanted work, he'd sure give it to him. It would be fun to get him out and run his tongue out. On the table lay a seed catalog half an inch thick. Casually, Bo leaned over, winked at Elsa, and seemed to be reading, paying no attention to Erling. Then he rose with the catalog in his hand.
"Through with this?"
"I guess so. Why?"
"Got to make a little trip," Bo said.
He took hold of the upper corner with his other hand. The blunt fingers tightened, his neck swelled and his shoulders hunched. The catalog tore slowly, reluctantly, until with a final twist he ripped it in two and went out without a word. Erling's eyes bulged. He looked at Elsa, who smiled.
"Holy cats," he said.
He took up the remaining half of the catalog and tried to tear it. It was like tearing a board.
"My gosh, he's strong," Erling said. "Where'd he get it?"
"Don't let him fool you," Elsa said. "Running a hotel, he's got a little soft, but I've seen him bend pokers with his hands." In her brother's transparent face, she saw half-contemptuous toleration giving way to awed respect. She could see him beginning to like this big guy that Elsa had married. One gesture, and the boy was his. It was hard to explain that knack he had of making men like him. "And women," she said. "Wasn't I just the same after one afternoon in Helm's parlor?" It was a kind of teasing and sultry and almost dangerous charm, a feeling of power you got from him as you got heat from a stove. She remembered the way he worked during that fall, how he set himself to go Erling one better in everything they did, how he hid his blistered hands until they were toughened and calloused, how every morning he and Erling wrestled out by the mill trough. Generally, those bouts wound up with Erling going head first into the tank. Big and agile as he was lost if he let Bo's hands get on him. Then he yelped like a stepped-on pup, and after the ducking he came up streaming water and blowing promises of what he would do next time he got that big goof, and ran steaming through the cold to change his overalls. Those were good, clean, sparkling mornings, bright with color, with popcorn drying from the rafters of the porch, and Chester was growing into such a handful that half the time they were scared to death he would kill himself, and half the time proud of his adventurousness. He was always wandering off into the cornfield by himself, or crawling up into the hayloft to burrow and growl at himself playing bear, or inducing visiting children, generally girls, to go swimming with him in the mill tank. In the evenings, Bo sparred with him, toughening him up, cuffing him on the ears as he sailed in, letting himself be flailed in return. Bruce was a different problem. Sometimes Bo would induce him to come in and fight, but one or two light flicks on the ear would set him howling. Bo got impatient then. He never could abide a child's crying.
Sometimes he roared at the boy to stop his noise, and once or twice he looked as if he might haul back and knock Bruce rolling if shame or Elsa's presence hadn't stopped him.
"You baby him too much," he said. "I never had any of this babying. I just got thrown out in the cold and had to get along. You've got Bruce so he bawls for any little thing."
"You let him alone," she said. "You can toughen Chet up all you want. He likes being knocked around. But Bruce is sensitive. You watch his face when you yell at him sometime. Just a little difference in your voice is enough to scare him."
"Yeah," Beau said heavily. "Yeah, I guess by God it is."
It was winter, the isolation and inactivity of just sitting and waiting for word from Judd that frayed his temper. Even when the letter from Judd came, it helped little. He had an offer of $3,000, less than half what he and Beau had paid, and he was holding off to see if something better could be stirred up. When he read it, Beau got out paper and pencil and figured for an hour, and when he got through figuring, he threw the pencil across the room and went outside. Next day, in a burst of activity, he sat down and wrote 9 letters, more than he had written in a year, 1 to a steamship line in Seattle, 2 to fur houses in St. Louis, 1 to his sister, 1 to Judd, 1 to Sears Roebuck, ordering some traps, 2 or 3 others she couldn't remember. Then he sat down and played solitaire till supper time. Inactivity was like a disease in him. He needed the excitement of starting something, getting something going. Being cooped up in the house made him grit his teeth. Haunting the mailbox for letters that didn't arrive set him swearing. And when he lost 35 straight games of solitaire without winning once, he threw down the cards and glared, and she knew from the look in his heavy-lidded eyes that he made an omen out of it. It was bad luck for the Klondike project. Before she could think of a way of distracting his mind from it, he was back at the table again, swearing he would sit there and play till he beat it if it took him till spring. But even after he had whipped it a good many times, the omen was not conquered. He slept uneasily, woke up sweating and whimpering like a lost pup from frightful dreams. She remembered the dream he had had 3 or 4 nights in a row that he worried over and tried to extract meaning from. He was a boy, fishing barefooted by the creek he had grown up on, with a watermelon on the bank beside him. He was there a long time and caught a lot of fish that came up shining from the silvery water, almost as if they flew, weightless and beautiful, each one bigger than the last. Then people started coming, his sister and his mother and all his brothers and Elsa and the children and Elsa's father and Sarah, and they all sat down and ate his watermelon, pushing him away when he protested and asking him for nickels. They caught in their hands the gleaming fish that flew upward when he pulled in the line. In disgust, he got up and moved to another hole, and the fish poured again in a silvery stream, beautiful, firm, glittering, slippery fish that he gloated over. Then they stopped biting suddenly, and he saw the cork riding motionless on the water. It grew and grew till it filled the whole stream, and he looked up to see the people coming again and ran. He ran across a sand beach, and by that time it wasn't people that chased him anymore, but some black thing that swooped above the trees with edges that waved up and down in the wind like the swimming motion of a flounder. And his feet stuck, and the thing was coming, and he woke up dripping wet when Elsa shook him and cried out to see what was making him moan so. Inactive days, haunted nights, wore out his patience and drove him against the shut doors that he wanted to burst open. He cursed Judd for not finding anyone to buy the hotel. One day he cursed the piddling nincompoop who had offered a measly $3,000, and the next he cursed Judd for not having the sense to take it. He didn't care how much they lost, as long as they got a stake to go north on. One day he sat in the kitchen and petted the gray house cat, rubbing behind its ears, stroking under its lifted chin, pulling its whiskers gently while it blinked and rubbed and purred. Elsa, turning at the stove to reach for the salt shaker, saw Beau's hand move down the crackling fur. The Tom arched his back and tiptoed as the fingers stroked clear from ears to lifting haunches up the raised and electric tail. Beau's face was passive, almost expressionless, and his eyes were half closed. Then the heavy thumbnail dug into the cat's tail with abrupt savagery. The cat yowled a startled, fighting yowl, turned and clawed and leaped free.
"God damn!"
Bo was on his feet, his face dark with a wash of blood. "Claw me, you damn—" The cat stood watchfully, yellow slit eyes on him, back humped, tail furred out and straight up. It leaped away from Bo's kick, slipped through the dining room door, dodged another kick, and vanished down the cellar stairs. Bo stood irresolute, fingering his scratched wrist.
"Damn cat clawed the hide off me," he said, and sucked at the blood.
"You started it. You pinched his tail."
"Oh, the hell I did."
"Bo, you did too. I saw you."
His heavy face, snarling, bullying, swung toward her. "And I say I didn't."
Her blood jumping with anger, she turned away from him. She had seen his face when he pinched, the sudden convulsive tightening of his mouth. Through February and into a bitter March, his irritability drove him from the house as if he couldn't bear to stay under a roof. He took to walking alone through the cornfield and down to the muddy little rill of water buried under the mounded snow in the creek bed, carrying a trap or two and looking for muskrat or fox or skunk sign. But all he caught was a half-dozen muskrats and two skunks, and coming home from his fruitless prowling, he would sit staring gloomily out the window, or try to lure Erling into a blackjack game, or get a deck and lose himself in solitaire. The sheets of tablet paper appeared again, and the strings of penman-like signatures and figures. Harry G. Mason. Harry G. Mason. Mr. Harry G. Mason. Mr. Harry G. Mason, Esquire. With arabesques and flourishes and pages of pictures of animals with bodies like frame houses, and heads like gables and tails like chimneys with curls of smoke rising. The boys pounced on those whenever they found them, but the sight of them made Elsa feel cold and a little sick. Brooding, the book forgotten in her lap, Elsa watched the children riding switches among the stumps, and even in the midst of the deep bird-twittering quiet, she felt the frustration and restlessness of that winter, all that energy bottled up without a thing to occupy it. And then the spring, and the sail, and that wonderful week or two when they were really on their way, and the world opened out westward into hope. She pursed her lips and shook her head. "You mustn't think about it," she said, and looked around, startled, to see if she had spoken aloud and the boys had heard. They were still playing horse among the stumps. But she mustn't think about it anyway. It did no good to worry over things that were done and gone. But she wished with all her heart that it hadn't happened, that they had caught the boat as they intended, that Bo were doing what he would have loved to do, playing wild man in the wilderness. She didn't like to think of herself and the children as a hoodoo and a handicap. Chapter 3 That night, after the boys were in bed, she put the lamp on the table and sat down to read. But the light, reflected off the oilcloth, hurt her eyes, and before 9 she was preparing for bed herself. After the light was out, she opened the door and stood for a minute, breathing the balsam air. It was very dark. The heavy trees, a black, impenetrable wall across the lighter, cleared ground, their tops, triangular blacknesses against the sky. She shivered. So lonely a place. The Klondike couldn't have been any lonelier. Ever since her marriage, she had wanted for neighbors, in the hotel and on her father's farm, and later in Seattle, when they knew no one. But now, for a moment, the desire to have people nearby was like a muscular ache. If there were only a smoke in the daytime, a light at night. Very carefully she bolted the door, looked at the unseen, flimsy canvas roof overhead, listened for a moment to the easy breathing of the children, and slipped into bed. No noises after dark, at least none like the sounds in a town. The hoarse calling of trains, the rattle of wheels and clack of hoofs, and squeak of a dry axle in the street, the unfamiliar roar of an automobile coming around a corner and diminishing, softening, disappearing again down another street, you could imagine, tree-lined, pooled with shadows, perhaps a single light in the gable of some house, and the dark pitch of roofs cutting off the stars. Nothing here but the soft, continuous murmur like a sigh from the trees crowding the clearing, nothing but the padded blow of an erratic, tree-broken wind on the canvas roof, the faint rustle of needles falling from the fir at the back corner of the tent and skating down the canvas incline. No noises but inanimate creakings and rustlings that you strained to hear and were never satisfied with, stealthy noises that eluded identification and kept you straining for their repetition, noises too soft to be comforting, noises without the surety and satisfaction of trains calling or freight cars jarring as they coupled in the yards beyond the dark. You lay rigidly in bed and made your breath come shallowly, noiselessly through your mouth, and your blood slowed and pounded until you felt its pressure like monotonous, light blows on your injured arm. When you had listened for a sound until you were tightened to an unbearable tension, you heard it again, and it was only the needles falling, the sigh of the moving trees, and you relaxed in the bed and breathed once more. It seemed to you then that your present was a static interval, like the pause between heartbeats, and when you lay thinking you thought of the past inevitably, because you couldn't help it, because the present was without the meaning of either past or future, because the past was the thing you knew well, in image and idea, because in the past your future lay. You remembered how the future had looked on that trip west, close and touchable and warm as it had been only once before in the early weeks of your marriage. You remembered the oceanic plains pouring behind, the mountains, the Elbow Pass above Banff, and the Three Sisters immaculate in snow behind the smoky windows, the strange smothery feeling in the tunnels, and the way the children's noses bled in the altitude, and then Seattle with Mount Rainier floating like a great smooth cloud high above where any mountain should be. Everything about those days was full of a kind of drunkenness. It reeled in the memory. Even the cheap boarding house where you and Eva and the children stayed while Judd and Beau went to arrange passage, even Eva forgetting to have her pains, full of laughter. The things sweet to remember. The terrier puppy you bought for the boys, and the pictures you had taken to send back to Indian Falls, Chester with a clay pipe in his mouth, looking droll and eyebrowless, holding the puppy in his arms. The two boys posed behind a cardboard screen painted to represent the cutwater of a boat, with spray V-ing out on both sides and Bruce's hands on an artificial wheel. The whole thing so convincing to the boys later that Bruce's greatest boast even yet was that he had run a big motorboat all by himself. The day when passage was arranged and the dog assured of a trip in the hold and the actual tickets in Beau's hands to prove that it was really going to happen. He was exalted with excitement, jumpy, full of sudden exuberances. He stood by the window looking out to where workmen with great fire hoses were washing away a whole hill to make way for a street, looking out and humming, breaking into song. It was at the Battle of Bunker Hill, that's where I lost my brother Bill. 'Twas a mighty hot fight, we'll all allow, but it's a damn sight hotter where Bill is now. Breaking into song, standing with his hands in his pockets, staring out at the activity of the city, and having crazy tunes come to his lips without warning, singing, "Oh, the Joneses, boys, they built a mill, they built it up the side of a hill, and they worked all night and they worked all day to try and make that old mill pay." When a hurdy-gurdy man came by under the window, you remembered him breaking from the window to wheel you in a clumsy waltz around the room, catching heels in the old Brussels carpet, stumbling, roaring with laughter, singing, "Those six Canadian boys were drowned, but the oxen swam to shore." Teasing the kids, wrestling the puppy, going out in the evening for pails of beer, and you all sat around in the scrawny room, full of fun and stories and songs, growing silent once in a while as you thought of the promised land. You remembered evenings when Judd and Eva had gone to their room, and those nights were full of warm, low talk in bed and love-making like a second honeymoon. Ah, that dream of escape, you thought now, lying in the dark tent, hearing the whisper of needles and the light breathing of the boys. That dream of taking from life exactly what you wanted. You too, not merely Beau and Judd, but all of you, drunk on that dream. Then the fall, the cracking away of the well brink just as you were climbing out. Ding-dong bell, pussies in the well, you thought, and made your face smile in the dark. Whose fault? Who put her in? Who pulled her out? You knew of no one responsible, unless whoever or whatever ran the world was really what it seemed sometimes, a mean, vindictive force against which you beat yourself to rags, so that sometimes you felt like a drowning sailor trying to climb into a lifeboat and having your fingers hammered off the gunwale time after time, until there was nothing to do except go down or make up your mind to stay afloat somehow, any way you could. There was Beau's face the day he came back from buying supplies for the voyage that would start now in 2 days, and found you tending Chester, sick and whining with a sore throat. The swift, hot, suspicious look, the look of outrage, the look, as you traced it over now, almost of certainty, as if he had known all along that something would happen. "God damn it!" he shouted. "He can't get sick now!" But he did. The next morning there was red rash in his throat. By noon it had spread all over his chest. By afternoon the man was tacking up scarlet fever signs on the boarding-house door, and most of the boarders had fled, and the landlady was bitter, and Beau, hearing the doctor's words, had flung out of the house like a madman, the doctor shouting after him. You expected then that he would go without you, and were bitter at him. Yet even then you couldn't have blamed him much. He had set his heart so on that voyage. You sat all afternoon and evening, and late at night he came back, his footsteps creaking on the stairs, the anger gone from him, and only a look of such hopeless defeat in his face that it shook you with pity. You begged him then to go, to get Judd and Eva and go, and you would join him when Chester was well. But he wouldn't. He had fought it out with himself walking, and he would stick. Maybe they could go later. All of them. But the quarantine would be 6 weeks, and 6 weeks cut half the season away. Instead of agreeing to go, he went out to find another boarding place. In the morning, he would look for a job. Should he get a nurse? He asked before he left. Could you get along with both kids to mind? But you didn't want a nurse. You didn't want to add that expense to what was already bound to be a disaster. You would stay afloat till another lifeboat came by. But no more boats. Empty ocean with a fog on it. Chester sick only a week when Bruce came down, and the quarantine lengthening through 2 weeks, 3, 4, 6, 7. Bruce was barely through peeling when his ear became infected, and he howled with pain so that no one slept. You remembered Beau's coming one night, slipping in after his shift of running a streetcar was done, and you sat almost wordless, beaten and tired, though you hadn't seen him for almost a month. Even then you still talked as if you might go. You would have exposed the children to any amount of cold winter if you could have gone that fall. But Beau had turned in the steamer tickets. Doctor's bills and living expenses had cut down their money. And then came Judd's first letter. It was a cautious letter. It didn't say definitely that there was nothing stirring. It said merely that, from all Judd could find out, the way to get in on either the gold or the fur was to go way back in the wilderness, and Eva didn't like that idea much. Living was high as a kite. Just to fill in till he had located some likely proposition for them, Judd was dealing poker in a joint. If he kept his ears open, he expected that pretty soon he'd hear of something that was worth plunging on. Until then, Judd suggested that with a family to take care of, Beau might do better to stay in Seattle. It was a hell of a lot cheaper to get along there than in Seward. You saw with the kind of slow, inevitable movement that a high wall makes in falling, that Beau's face lost its eagerness, sagged, set hard. He crushed the letter and threw it at the wall. After a while he picked it up again, smoothed it out, and read it again. and broke into a fit of foul swearing, and looking at his eyes and mouth, you knew he wanted to cry. He wore that bitterness around his mouth for months, until he heard about the little café for sale in Richmond, out in the timber, and the prospect of getting away from the car line, from the rocking platform and the swollen feet and the irritation of working for someone else, checking in and checking out, keeping still when inspectors bawled him out, was too tempting to resist. He never looked into the café at all carefully. He simply quit his job and took what little money they had and bought it, spent 10 days furiously painting and cobbling and cleaning up, bought new stools and coffee urn and equipment. You flicked the shutter open on that café, and your eye saw it as you had seen it for 6 months, clean and painted and neat outside, where the customers saw it, its poverty plain where the poverty wouldn't show. You saw the scuffed, softened, splintery fir floor behind the counter, the floor whose slivers found the holes in your shoes and drove in, stopping you sometimes as if you had stepped in a trap, the old cupboards that no amount of soda and scrubbing would sweeten. But even so, you said, even so, it's better. It's steady, and it does make us a living, and since I've been hurt, Bo seems to be willing to stick with it. That accident, unlucky as it seemed at the time, was a point of change, a climax of the bad luck, and since it was over, things were better. You remembered old Lady Mo at home in Indian Falls, and her belief that whenever she broke a dish she was bound to break three, and you remembered the day you saw her drop a saucer when she was serving afternoon coffee, and how she threw down a cup and another saucer on top of it, not angrily, not in a pet, but quite carefully, as if to finish a job. That was the way the burn was. You were getting ready for the breakfast customers. You were mixing pancake batter, Bo cleaning the coffee urn. He had emptied it, wiped it out, put in the fresh coffee, and heated the water in a pail. As you stirred the batter at the other end, you saw him kick a low stool into place and climb up with the steaming water in his hand. He shifted the pail, reached down awkwardly for a dish towel, wrapped it around his right hand, and took hold of the pail again to lift. The urn was high. He had to strain to hoist the pail. The lip caught under the flange of the urn top, and he hung there teetering on the precarious stool. "Come here, quick!" he said. You put down the bowl of batter, wiped your hands on a towel, started. "Hurry up!" he shouted. "This is scalding my hand!" You were over to him in 3 steps, looking to see what he wanted you to do. "The stool!" Bo yelled. "The stool! The stool! The stool!" He could have lowered the pail and started over, but that was not his way. Convulsed with fury and strain, he shouted at you and kept the steaming pail jammed as high as he could reach. You grabbed the stool and held its teetering legs back on the floor, and Bo staggered, stuck his hand desperately at the wall, letting go of the bottom of the pail. Hot water slopped over him, and with a yell he dropped it and leaped back to save himself. The whole bucket of scalding water came down across your shoulder and arm. And then Bo's face again. So many times the memory projected an image of his face, the exact expression. You stood there, your teeth in your lip and your body rigid with the shock, your bare arm, in the time you could count 10, turned fiery, clear to the fingers. His face fallen in a kind of anguish. Bo stared at the arm and then at your face, and you held yourself rigid, not quite aware yet how badly you were hurt, and looked at him. He burst out as if he couldn't bear what he saw. "Yell! God damn it to hell! Yell! Cry!" Then he was grabbing the butter can and smearing your arm, roughly, angrily. Under his fingers the skin puffed in great blisters, growing while you watched. By the time Bo closed up the place and routed out a stage driver to take you down to the doctor's little office on the mill road, your arm was twice as big as normal, and so hot and painful that you staggered getting out of the stage, and Bo picked you up and carried you into the office. His face, it was almost as if you touched it lovingly, seeing how strongly your lives had been welded together in spite of bad luck and bad temper, how behind all the violent irritability and the restlessness and the dissatisfaction, you were his wife. You had never known what that meant, really, until you saw how it shook him to see you hurt. In the bed, Elsa stiffened. There was something, a sound not skating needles or sigh of trees or soft blows of wind on canvas. Rigid with listening, she waited. Again, like the stealthy pad of feet at the rear of the tent, a sound as if something were prowling around the little shed where they stored food, the trunk, clothing, everything that overflowed from the tent itself. Her eyes wide upon the sightless dark, her head half lifted from the pillow, she listened. And the heavy pound of blood began in her burned arm. There again. She strained her ears, as she had strained them 100 times at night noises, tight with fear that was not really fear, but only apprehension that wanted to smile at itself, to take a long breath and relax again, and know that what had brought it upright, listening, was only the wind, or the settling of timbers in the house, or the creak of a swaying door. A long, furtive silence, the sigh of the wind, and then the noise of a stick of firewood falling on the woodpile. It was as if a light had flashed on and made abruptly real all the fears that she hadn't really believed in. There was something out there, prowling in the dark, and if it was friendly, it wouldn't prowl at this hour. Like a shutter that clicked 3 times, 3 swift thoughts went through her mind. The automatic question of what time it was, and when Beau would be home, the realization that it couldn't be more than 10 o'clock, and the thought of the cougar. Propped now on her elbow, she still listened. No more wood fell, but the soft sound of steps came through the flimsy canvas, and then, unmistakably, the rattle of the padlock against the hasp on the shed door. Very slowly, so as not to make a noise, Elsa laid the covers back and inched her feet over the edge of the bed. The springs squeaked, and she waited with held breath. The noise outside was still there. It sounded as if the cougar, or whatever it was, had gotten into the shed. Even while she stood up, she was wondering if she had padlocked that door, but she couldn't remember. She had been out to hang the ham on its hook just after supper. For a moment, standing barefooted on the cold board floor, she cocked eyes and ears at the children's bed. Sleeping. She knew what she must do. It froze her with terror, but she knew. She must drive the thing away, frighten it so it would never come back, kill it if she could. For what peace would she ever have now, when she had to leave the children alone, as she often had to do when she was helping at the café? With her hurt arm held across her body, she tiptoed to the bureau, felt for the revolver on the high shelf. Her teeth were locked, and her body shivered as if with cold, but she went on over to the door. There she stooped, laid the gun on the floor, raised up and drew the bolt very slowly with her good hand, stooped again and picked up the gun. It was awkward left-handed, but it was better that way than trying to use the burned one. On the narrow porch she listened again. Something bumped back in the darkness by the shed. The thing was bolder. All around her the dark ring of woods pressed on the less opaque darkness of the clearing, and she saw the cloudy sky above moving with the wind as silently and almost as invisibly as a thought moves in a mind. For a moment she wondered what she would do if the thing didn't scare, if it turned and attacked her. But she shut her determination down and clenched her teeth upon it. In her bare feet, feeling the needles and tiny twigs digging into her skin, she stepped off into the yard and 12 steps to the side to where she could see the blob of shadow that was the shed. With all her will, knowing she must do it quickly or not at all, she lifted the gun and pointed it at the place where the shed door ought to be. Her hand wobbled, and she braced it with the hurt one.
"Beau!" she cried out in a last forlorn hope. "Beau, is it you?"
There was a rush of movement, a half-seen, moving shadow. The shed door banged back as the retreating animal bumped it, and with her teeth in her lip, Elsa pulled the trigger. The noise stunned her. The recoil threw her hands into the air and stabbed her arm with knives of pain. Slowly she let her hands come down with the gun, her mind still dazzled by the flash and the report and something else. The wild howl that still shivered against the ring of trees, an almost human howl. Before she realized that she had heard it, that the prowler had been real, and that she had shot at it, perhaps hit it, she was back inside the tent, leaning weakly against the slammed and bolted door. Both boys were sitting up in bed, tousled and sleepy, shocked upright before they had had a chance to awaken.
"What was it, Ma?" Chester said.
His eyes, round with sleep and wonder, were on the gun hanging from her hand. Bruce whined, dug with his knuckles at the lingering sleep in his eyes. Then he too saw the gun, and his baby face slackened with the imminence of tears. Elsa laughed, a squeaky, hysterical cackle, forcing casualness over her panic like a tight lid over a saucepan. She went over and put the gun back on the shelf.
"It was just an old skunk snooping around your rabbit pen," she said.
Chester knew about skunks. He sniffed.
"I scared him off before he had a chance to make a smell,"
his mother said, and laughed again, more naturally.
"Did you shoot him?"
"You bet I did. We don't want any old skunks bothering our rabbits, do we?"
Their solemn heads shook.
"No."
"All right," she said,
and went to tuck their covers back.
"You go to sleep. If Pa comes home and finds you still awake, he'll skin you alive."
They lay down again, punched one another for sleeping room, whispered together with secret giggles, and finally fell asleep. But Elsa, after playing at going back to bed just to fool them, got up again and dressed, and she was sitting by the table with the light turned up and bright when Beau's feet scraped on the steps. She met him at the door with her finger on her lips, and when she told him what had happened, he whistled low.
"Scare you?"
She held up her left hand, trembling again now that everything was over and Beau was back. She could even laugh a little.
"Half to death," she said.
"Did you hit him?"
"I don't know. He screeched bloody murder and ran away. I didn't even see him, just a kind of rush in the dark."
"Maybe you were seeing shadows."
"He was not a shadow. He yelled like old Nick. He was in the shed."
"How'd he get in there?"
"I don't know. Maybe I left the door open."
"Even if you did, there's a thumb latch."
"I heard the latch rattle. Maybe the door wasn't caught."
He reached down the gun from the shelf, picked up the lamp, and took her arm.
"Well, let's go see if we've got a cougar rug."
While Elsa held the lantern high, Beau, with the brighter light of the lamp, went into the shed and looked. Immediately his voice came excited.
"By God, there was something in here. Stuff's all scattered around."
"Did you think I was imagining things?"
"I did, sort of," he said.
He came out and searched for tracks, but the ground was so littered it wouldn't have taken a clear print. Then Elsa stooped and picked up a chip at the corner. On one edge was a dark spatter, and when Beau rubbed it with his thumb, it came off red. He looked at her.
"You winged him, anyway."
He searched, stooping, the light silhouetting his head and shoulders and shining yellow on the side of his intent face. He seemed to sniff like a hound. There was excitement in him. 20 feet from the corner, he found another spatter of blood on a spruce twig. After that, he found nothing.
"I'll get up early and try it in the morning," he said. "No use in the dark."
His arm went across her shoulders, and she giggled without knowing she was going to, a sound as involuntary as a hiccup.
"Old mama," he said, "pops off a lion with one shot. How'd you ever get the nerve to go right out after him?"
"I wanted to scare him good or kill him so he'd never come back."
He paused, stooping for a last look.
"This is the best place for tracks where there's dust," he said.
The wind flawed in the light, and he cupped a hand over the chimney. There were footprints all around in the dust, but no sign of animal tracks. Then Beau bent closer.
"Ah," he said.
"What?"
"Look."
He pointed to a large footprint, set his own foot down beside it, and made a track. His print was an inch longer than the other. They stared at each other. The light spread around them dimly, shone on the side of the shed, was cut off at the corner as if a knife had sliced it. The woodpile was a jumbled and crisscross pile of shadows.
"If that was a cougar you shot," Beau said, "he was wearing number 9 shoes."
There was little sleep for her that night. In spite of Beau's reassurances that no court would hold her a minute, even if she had killed the prowler, the thought of having shot a man left her weak and sick. She imagined him out in the dark, hungry maybe, rummaging among the things in the shed while he listened for noises from the tent, as fearfully as she listened from her bed. Then the shout-out of the dark, the terror of discovery, the desperate running, the shot, the pain, the mouth wide on a scream. She imagined him dragging himself off into the woods, perhaps to die. There was nothing she could do, because Beau said flatly he wasn't going to lose a night's sleep hunting for him in the dark. Besides, he might be dangerous, and as for his bleeding to death, there would have been more blood than they'd found if she had hit him badly. The hell with going sleepless and maybe getting shot at out of pity for any burglar. She knew that he wasn't in the least afraid to go out, that he was merely tired and needed sleep, but she could not go to sleep as he did. 5 minutes after they were in bed, he had started kicking the covers off his feet, and hers. His muscles twitched as he slept. In the other bed, one of the children whimpered, dreaming. It was comforting to know that nothing worse than dreams would touch him tonight. She should try to get to sleep. Beau rolled over, the bed sagging away under his weight, and she fought him for the covers. He was like an elephant in bed. You couldn't wake him up, and whenever he moved, he stripped the whole bed bare. It took savage jabs in the ribs before he would even grunt and squirm and give you enough slack to pull over you. The child whimpered again. Which one? Bruce? You couldn't tell. Never mind. Let yourself go. Feel your weight relaxing into the bed. The scream brought her out onto the floor in a single leap. Confused, her heart shuddering after its first great bound. Where? What? The baby. He was screaming insanely, babbling, clopping his lips. Even when she felt across Chester and found Bruce backed against the wall and took him up to hold his face against her shoulder and comfort him, he still choked and cried. As hard to waken as a mummy, Beau stirred and grumbled a question, but she didn't answer because she was busy crooning to Bruce, running her hand up and down his shivering, wet back.
"There, there, there," she said. "It was just a dream. Nothing's going to hurt you. Mommy's got you safe."
He pressed against her and locked his arms around her neck.
"Cougar," he said. "Great big old cougar had me."
Finally, to quiet him, she lay down between the two boys, and they jackknifed their little bottoms into her body and went to sleep again. But she lay as wakeful as ever, staring upward. That fool business of loading the gun and making such a fuss. It had already caused Bruce to be afraid of going 15 feet from the tent, had made her shoot a man, had wakened the baby from his sleep drenched with nightmare sweat. Just once it would be pleasant to live in a place where you felt safe and secure and permanent. The canvas roof was dingy gray, and the birds were beginning off in the woods before she fell asleep. Chapter 4 It was broad daylight when she awoke. The children were running naked in and out of the tent, and Beau was getting breakfast on a little iron stove. The good smell, mingled with the clean scent of the woods that blew in the open door, filled the tent. There was a golden patch of sun on the floor, and the roof was dappled with gold. For a moment, not remembering, she stretched luxuriously. It was good of Beau not to wake her early, because when you woke of your own accord, there was pleasure in wakening. Every detail of the tent house was intimate and precious, the 4-foot board walls, the canvas patched near the ridge with 2 neat seaman-like patches, the table and bench and stools and bureau, all of which Beau had made, the light pine wood worn smooth by the rubbing of hands and clothing. The whole day ahead was full of comfortable chores, home chores. She watched Beau at the stove. He was a good cook, better than she was at some things, and he seemed to like to sneak out of bed before anyone was up. He turned the bacon, tipped the lid of the coffee pot to look in, flipped it down again with a light clank of metal. He was whistling under his breath. Still not aware that she was awake, he turned to watch the boys scuffling in the corner over a toy boat, and she saw the skin around his eyes wrinkle. As he turned back to the frying pan, his whistle turned into a hum, the hum into a song. "My sweetheart's a mule in the mines. I drive her without any lines. Behind her I sit, and tobacco I spit, all over my sweetheart's behind." Just that little excitement last night could make him this way, she thought. Just one unusual thing, one break in the monotony, and he chirped like a bird. His movements were quick, almost jigging, like the movements of a Negro she had seen working on the docks at Seattle, as if at any minute he might break into a dance. The coffee pot began to steam, and Beau opened the lid so that a damp flaw wavered and clanged against the stovepipe like the witch in the throat of a fireplace. He sang, "Once upon a time, boys, an Irishman named Doherty was elected to the Senate by a very large majority." The bacon fizzed, and he turned it over, the song breaking and emerging again further on. "Oh, they ate up everything that was upon the bill of fare, and then they turned it over to see if any more was there. There was bluefish, greenfish, dried fish and partridges, fish balls, snowballs, cannonballs and cartridges." Then she remembered. "Bo!" He turned around with a grin. "Shouldn't we go out and look?" He let his voice sink to sepulchral depths.
"While you snored like a pig, I already looked," he said. "I plow deep while sluggards sleep."
"Was there?"
"Not a sign," he said. "You couldn't have done more than scratch his hide. I've been all around, clear out to the road."
"I guess I didn't get to sleep till pretty late," she said. She swung her legs over the side of the bed, saw Bruce watching her, and said, "You didn't help either, you little pumpkin. You had a nightmare and screamed as if you were being murdered."
Looking at Bruce, Beau said, "What'd give him nightmares?"
"You," she said, popping her head into her dress. "You and your fool guns and stories about cougars."
"He's got teeth," Bruce said. "He wars."
Beau laughed.
"He wars, does he?" Standing spraddle-legged, he winked at the child. "Tell you what, when you see that cougar poke his nose into the open, you sail right up to him, and when he opens his mouth to eat you, you stick your arm down his throat and grab his tail and yank him inside out."
Bruce's round face wavered in a grin.
"He can't eat me," he said. "I'll kill him right down."
"That's the ticket," his father said. "Kill him right down. Pull off his leg and beat him over the head with the bloody end of it."
"You'll have them talking like toughs," Elsa said. Beau was sitting down, cramming his mouth with bacon and fried bread.
"Do him good. Make him so tough a cougar's teeth would clinch right over if he tried to bite him."
He made motions as if his jaws were glued together, frowned, pawed at his face, put his head down and bucked up and down in his chair, puzzled and wrathful. Both boys laughed. Beau winked at them, took a knife from the table, pried his jaws open, gulped half a cup of coffee, and stood up.
"Gotta hustle," he said. "I'm late now."
This was her morning to go in and see the doctor. At 10 o'clock she had the children washed and cleaned up, and started with them down the path toward the macadam road. They walked for a half mile under a roof of horizontal limbs, almost uniformly a dozen feet from the ground, and so tightly laced over the old tote road that on rainy days it was possible to walk almost dry from the road to the tent. In that tight, shaded aisle, and in the woods that thickened in brown tangles on both sides, there were no flowers brightening the mat of needles, but in the openings where the sun reached, the color was spread in bright patches, flowers unfamiliar to her childhood, but looking as if they might be relatives of the wildflowers and cornflowers of home. There was even one that looked like a furry-stemmed pasc flower. The boys had names for all of them, many of them the product of Beau's foolery. There was a little delicate blue blossom as low and hidden as a violet that he had taught them to call a hocus-pocus crocus, and another, a rose blossom that grew on a sort of berry bush, which he called a blush of shame for a life ill-spent. If the boys ever did learn the names of things, they would have to unlearn a lot of his teachings first. Chester ran ahead, picking up cones and bending back the scales to look for seeds, but Bruce stuck close by her side, and she realized with a strange feeling of helplessness how the fear of the woods had taken hold of him. He had always been afraid of everything—horses, cows, streetcars, strange people, even the Santa Claus in the Bon Marché toy department in Seattle. Dark terrors seemed to drive him sometimes into propitiatory rituals— sending him round the tent before a meal, touching with solemn, babyish pats the bench, the bureau, the leg of the stove, the headboard of his bed. If he were hustled to his chair to eat, he lost his head completely, squalled, fought to get back and finish his compulsive ritual. Or he would turn against foods without warning, so that one would have thought he was being offered offal, and not coaxing, not scolding, not spanking, could make him eat one day what he had been ravenous for the day before. He was a strange